29. Saul Weintraub had high hopes the night the consul left. At last, they were doing something. Or trying to. Saul did not believe that the cryogenic vaults of the consul's ship would be the answer to saving Rachel. Medical experts on Renaissance Vector had pointed out the extreme danger of that procedure. But it was good to have an alternative, any alternative. And Saul felt that they had been passive long enough, awaiting the Shrike's pleasure, like condemned criminals awaiting the guillotine. The interior of the Sphinx seemed too treacherous this night, and Saul brought their possessions out on the broad granite porch of the tomb, where he and Duray sought to make Mastine and Braun comfortable, under blankets and capes, with packs for pillows. Braun's medical monitors continued to show no brain activity whatsoever, while her body rested comfortably. Mastine turned and tossed in the grip of fever.
"What do you think the Templar's problem is?" asked Duray. "Disease?"
"It could be simple exposure," said Saul. "After being abducted from the wind wagon, he found himself wandering in the barrens and here in the valley of the Time Tombs. He was eating snow for liquid and had no food at all."
Duray nodded and checked the force med patch they had attached to the inside of Mastine's arm. The telltales showed the steady drip of intravenous solution.
"But it seems to be something else," said the Jesuit. "Almost a madness."
"Templars have an almost telepathic connection to their tree ships," said Saul. "It must have driven Voice of the Tree Mastine a bit mad when he watched the destruction of the Yggdrasil, especially if he somehow knew it was necessary."
Doray nodded and continued sponging the Templar's waxy forehead. It was after midnight, and the wind had come up, moving vermilion dust in lazy spirals and moaning around the wings and rough edges of the Sphinx. The tombs glowed brightly and then dimmed, now one tomb, then the next, in no apparent order or sequence. Occasionally, the tug of time tides would assail both men, making them gasp and grip the stone. But the wave of déjà vu and vertigo would fade after a moment. With Braun Lamia attached to the Sphinx via the cable welded to her skull, they could not leave. Some time before dawn, the clouds parted and the sky became visible, the thickly clustered stars almost painful in their clarity. For a while, the only signs of the great fleets warring there were the occasional fusion trails, narrow, diamond scratches on the pane of night. But then the blossoms of distant explosions began to unfurl again, and within the hour the glow of the tombs had been dimmed by the violence above.
"Who do you think will win?" asked Father Duray.
The two men sat with their backs to the stone wall of the Sphinx, faces raised to the cusp of sky revealed between the tomb's forward curved wings. Saul was rubbing Rachel's back as she slept on her stomach, rear end raised under the thin blankets.
"From what the others say, it seems preordained that the web must suffer a terrible war."
"So you believe the AI Advisory Council's predictions?"
Saul shrugged in the darkness.
"I really know nothing about politics, or the Corps' accuracy in predicting things. I'm a minor scholar from a small college on a backwater world. But I have the feeling that something terrible is in store for us, that some rough beast is slouching toward Bethlehem to be born."
Duray smiled.
"Yeats," he said.
The smile faded.
"I suspect that this place is the new Bethlehem."
He looked down the valley toward the glowing tombs.
"I spent a lifetime teaching about St. Teilhard's theories of evolution toward the Omega Point. Instead of that, we have this, human folly in the skies, and the terrible Antichrist waiting to inherit the rest."
"You think that the Shrike is the Antichrist?"
Father Duray set his elbows on his raised knees and folded his hands.
"If it's not, we're all in trouble."
He laughed bitterly.
"It wasn't long ago that I would have been delighted to discover an Antichrist. Even the presence of some anti-divine power would have served to shore up my failing belief in any form of divinity."
"And now?" Saul asked quietly. Duray spread his fingers.
"I too have been crucified.
Saul thought of the images from the Narhoit story about Duray. The elderly Jesuit nailing himself to a Tesla tree, suffering the years of pain and rebirth rather than surrender to the cruciform DNA parasite which even now burrowed under the flesh of his chest. Duray lowered his face from the sky.
"There was no welcome from a heavenly father," he said softly. "No reassurance that the pain and sacrifice had been worth anything. Only pain. Pain and darkness. And then pain again."
Saul's hand stopped moving on his infant's back. "And that made you lose your faith?" Duray looked at Saul.
"On the contrary, it made me feel that faith is all the more essential. Pain and darkness have been our lot since the fall of man. But there must be some hope that we can rise to a higher level, that consciousness can evolve to a plane more benevolent than its counterpoint of a universe hardwired to indifference."
Saul nodded slowly. "I had a dream during Rachel's long battle with Merlin's sickness. My wife Sarai had the same dream, that I was being called to sacrifice my only daughter."
"Yes," said Duray. "I listened to the consul's summary on disk."
"Then you know my response," said Saul.
"First, that Abraham's path of obedience can no longer be followed, even if there is a God demanding such obedience. Second, that we have offered sacrifices to that God for too many generations, that the payments of pain must stop."
"Yet you are here,"
said Duray, gesturing toward the valley, the tombs, the night.
"I'm here," agreed Saul. "But not to grovel, rather to see what response these powers have to my decision."
He touched his daughter's back again.
"Rachel is a day and a half old now, and growing younger each second. If the Shrike is the architect of such cruelty, I want to face him, even if he is your Antichrist. Even if there is a God and he has done this thing, I will show the same contempt to him."
"Perhaps we've all shown too much contempt as it is," mused Duray.
Saul looked up, as a dozen pinpoints of fierce light expanded into ripples and shockwaves of plasma explosions far out in space.
"I wish we had the technology to fight God on an equal basis," he said in low, tight tones. "To beard him in his den, to fight back for all of the injustices heaped on humanity, to allow him to alter his smug arrogance or be blown to hell."
Father Duray raised one eyebrow, then smiled slightly.
"I know the anger you feel."
The priest gently touched Rachel's head.
"Let's try to get some sleep before sunrise, shall we?"
Saul nodded, lay next to his child, and pulled the blanket up to his cheek. He heard Duray whispering something that might have been a soft good night, or perhaps a prayer. Saul touched his daughter, closed his eyes, and slept. The Shrike did not come in the night, nor did it come the next morning, as sunlight painted the southwestern cliffs and touched the top of the crystal monolith. Saul awoke as sunlight crept down the valley. He found Duray sleeping next to him, Mastine and Braun still unconscious. Rachel was stirring and fussing. Her cry was that of a hungry newborn. Saul fed her with one of the last nursing packs, pulling the heating tab and waiting a moment for the milk to reach body temperature. Cold had settled in the valley overnight, and frost glinted on the steps to the Sphinx. Rachel ate greedily, making the soft mewling and sucking sounds that Saul remembered from more than 50 years earlier, as Sarai had nursed her. When she finished, Saul burped her and left her on his shoulder, as he rocked gently to and fro. A day and a half left. Saul was very tired. He was growing old despite the single Poulsen treatment a decade earlier. At the time, he and Sarai would normally have been freed of parental duties, their only child in graduate school and off on an archaeological dig in the outback. Rachel had fallen prey to Merlin's sickness, and parenthood had soon descended upon them once again.
The curve of those duties rose as Saul and Sarai grew older, then Saul alone, after the air crash on Barnard's World. And now he was very, very tired. But despite that, despite everything, Saul was interested to note that he did not regret a single day of caring for his daughter. A day and a half left. Father Duray awoke after a bit, and the two men made breakfast from the various canned goods Braun had brought back with her. Het Mastin did not awaken, but Duray applied the next-to-last med pack, and the Templar began receiving fluids and IV nutrient.
"Do you think Emlamia should have the last med pack applied?" asked Duray.
Saul sighed and checked her comlog monitors again.
"I don't think so, Paul. According to this, blood sugar is high. Nutrient levels check out as if she had just eaten a decent meal." "But how?"
Saul shook his head.
"Perhaps that damned thing is some sort of umbilical."
He gestured toward the cable attached to the point in her skull where the neural shunt socket had been.
"So what do we do today?"
Saul peered at a sky already fading to the green and lapis dome they had grown used to on Hyperion.
"We wait," he said.
Het Mastin awoke in the heat of the day, shortly before the sun reached the zenith. The Templar sat straight up and said,
"The tree!"
Duray hurried up the steps from where he had been pacing below. Saul lifted Rachel from where she lay in shadow near the wall and moved to Mastin's side. The Templar's eyes were focused on something above the level of the clouds. Saul glanced up but could see only the paling sky.
"The tree!"
cried the Templar again and lifted one roughened hand. Duray restrained the man.
"He's hallucinating. He thinks he sees the Yggdrasil, his tree ship."
Het Mastin struggled against their hands.
"No, not the Yggdrasil,"
he gasped through parched lips.
"The tree, the final tree, the tree of pain."
Both men looked up then, but the sky was clear except for wisps of clouds blowing in from the southwest. At that moment there was a surge of time tides, and both Saul and the priest bowed their heads in sudden vertigo. It passed. Het Mastin was trying to get to his feet. The Templar's eyes were still focused on something far away. His skin was so hot that it burned Saul's hands.
"Get the final med pack," snapped Saul. "Program the ultramorph and anti-fever agent."
Duray hurried to comply.
"The tree of pain," managed Het Mastin. "I was meant to be its voice. The Urg is meant to drive it through space and time. The bishop and the voice of the great tree have chosen me. I cannot fail them."
He strained against Saul's arms a second, then collapsed back to the stone porch.
"I am the true chosen,"
he whispered, energy leaving him like air from an emptying balloon.
"I must guide the tree of pain during the time of atonement."
He closed his eyes. Duray attached the final med pack, made sure the monitor was set for Templar quirks in metabolism and body chemistry, and triggered the adrenaline and painkillers. Saul huddled over the robed form.
"That's not Templar terminology or theology," said Duray. "He's using Shrike cult language."
The priest caught Saul's eye.
"That explains some of the mystery, especially from Braun's tale. For some reason, the Templars have been in collusion with the Church of the Final Atonement, the Shrike cult."
Saul nodded, slipped his own comlog on Mastin's wrist, and adjusted the monitor.
"The Tree of Pain must be the Shrike's fabled Tree of Thorns," muttered Duray, glancing up at the empty sky where Mastin had been staring. "But what does he mean that he and the Urg were chosen to drive it through space and time? Does he really think he can pilot the Shrike's tree, the way the Templars do the tree ships? Why?"
"You'll have to ask him in the next life," said Saul tiredly. "He's dead." Duray checked the monitors, added Lenar Hoyt's comlog to the array. They tried the medpack revival stimulants, CPR, and mouth-to-mouth resuscitation. The monitor telltales did not waver. Het Mastin, Templar, true voice of the tree, and Shrike Pilgrim, was indeed dead. They waited an hour, suspicious of all things in this perverse valley of the Shrike. But when the monitors began showing rapid decomposition of the corpse, they buried Mastine in a shallow grave 50 meters up the trail toward the entrance to the valley. Cassatt had left behind a collapsible shovel labeled entrenching tool in forced jargon, and the men took turns digging while the other watched over Rachel and Braun Lamia. The two men, one cradling a child, stood in the shadow of a boulder while Duray said a few words before the soil was dropped onto the makeshift fiber-plastic shroud.
"I did not truly know M. Mastine," said the priest. "We were not of the same faith, but we were of the same profession. Voice of the Tree, Mastine spent much of his life doing what he understood to be God's work, pursuing God's will in the writings of the Muir and the beauties of nature. His was the true faith, tested by difficulties, tempered by obedience, and in the end, sealed by sacrifice."
Duray paused and squinted into a sky that had faded to gunmetal glare.
"Please accept your servant, O Lord. Welcome him into your arms as you will someday welcome us, your other searchers who have lost their way. In the name of the Father, and of the Son, and of the Holy Spirit. Amen."
Rachel began to cry. Saul walked her around as Duray shoveled the earth onto the man-shaped bundle of fiber plastic. They returned to the porch of the Sphinx and gently moved Braun into what little shade remained. There was no way to shield her from the late afternoon sun unless they carried her into the tomb itself, and neither man wanted to do that.
"The consul must be more than halfway to the ship by now," said the priest after taking a long drink of water.
The man's forehead was sunburned and filmed with sweat.
"Yes," said Saul. "By this time tomorrow, he should be back here. We'll use laser cutters to free Braun, then set her in the ship surgery. Perhaps Rachel's reverse aging can be arrested in cryogenic storage, despite what the doctor said."
"Yes." Duray lowered the water bottle and looked at Saul.
"Do you believe that is what will happen?"
Saul returned the other man's gaze.
"No."
Shadows stretched from the southwestern cliff walls. The day's heat coalesced into a solid thing, then dissipated a bit. Clouds moved in from the south. Rachel slept in the shadows near the doorway. Saul walked up to where Paul Duray stood staring down the valley and set a hand on the priest's shoulder.
"What are you thinking about, my friend?"
Duray did not turn.
"I am thinking that if I did not truly believe that suicide was a mortal sin, that I would end things to allow young Hoyt a chance at life."
He looked at Saul and showed a hint of smile.
"But is it suicide when this parasite on my chest, on his chest then, would someday drag me kicking and screaming to my own resurrection?"
"Would it be a gift to Hoyt?" asked Saul quietly. "To bring him back to this?"
Duray said nothing for a moment. Then he clasped Saul's upper arm.
"I think that I shall take a walk."
"Where?"
Saul squinted out at the thick heat of the desert afternoon. Even with the low cloud cover, the valley was an oven. The priest made a vague gesture.
"Down the valley. I will be back before too long."
"Be careful," said Saul. "And remember, if the consul runs across a patrol skimmer along the Huli, he might be back as early as this afternoon."
Duray nodded, went over to pick up a water bottle and to touch Rachel gently. And then he went down the long stairway of the Sphinx, picking his way slowly and carefully, like an old, old man. Saul watched him leave, becoming a smaller and smaller figure, distorted by heat waves and distance. Then Saul sighed and went back to sit near his daughter. Paul Duray tried to keep to the shadows, but even there the heat was oppressive, weighing on him like a great yoke on his shoulders. He passed the jade tomb and followed the path toward the northern cliffs and the obelisk. That tomb's thin shadow painted darkness on the roseate stone and dust of the valley floor. Descending again, picking his way through the rubble surrounding the crystal monolith, Duray glanced up as a sluggish wind moved shattered panes and whistled through cracks high up on the face of the tomb. He saw his reflection in the lower surfaces and remembered hearing the organ song of the evening wind rising from the cleft when he had found the Bikura high on the Pinyon Plateau. That seemed like lifetimes ago. It was lifetimes ago. Duray felt the damage the cruciform reconstruction had done to his mind and memory. It was sickening, the equivalent of suffering a stroke with no hope of recovery. Reasoning that once would have been child's play to him now required extreme concentration or was simply beyond his ability. Words eluded him. Emotions tugged at him with the same sudden violence as the time tides. Several times he had had to leave the other pilgrims while he wept in solitude for no reason he could understand. The other pilgrims. Now only Saul and the child remained. Father Duray would gladly surrender his own life if those two could be spared. Wasn't it a sin, he wondered, to plan deals with the Antichrist? He was far down the valley now, almost to the point where it curved eastward into the widening cul-de-sac, where the Shrike Palace threw its maze of shadows across the rocks. The trail wound close to the northwest wall as it passed the cave tombs. Duray felt the cool air from the first tomb and was tempted to enter just to recover from the heat, close his eyes, and take a nap. He continued walking. The entrance to the second tomb had more Baroque carvings in the stone, and Duray was reminded of the ancient basilica he had discovered in the cleft, the huge cross and altar where the retarded Bikura had worshipped. It had been the obscene immortality of the cruciform they had been worshipping, not the chance of true resurrection promised by the cross. But what was the difference? Duray shook his head, trying to clear the fog and cynicism that clouded every thought. The path wound higher here, past the third cave tomb, the shortest and least impressive of the three. There was a light in the third cave tomb. Duray stopped, took a breath, and glanced back down the valley. The Sphinx was quite visible, almost a kilometer away, but he could not quite make out Saul in the shadows. For a moment, Duray wondered if it had been the third tomb they had sheltered in the day before, if one of them had left a lantern there. It had not been the third time tomb. Except for the search for Kassad, no one had entered this tomb in 3 days. Father Duray knew that he should ignore the light, return to Saul, keep the vigil with the man and his daughter.
But the Shrike came to each of the others separately. Why should I refuse the summons?
Duray felt moisture on his cheek and realized that he was weeping soundlessly, mindlessly. He roughly wiped the tears away with the back of his hand and stood there clenching his fists.
My intellect was my greatest vanity. I was the intellectual Jesuit, secure in the tradition of Teor and Prasad. Even the theology I pushed on the church, on the seminarians, and on those few faithful still listening, had emphasized the mind, that wonderful omega point of consciousness. God as a clever algorithm. Well, some things are beyond intellect, Paul.
Duray entered the third cave tomb. Saul awoke with a start, sure that someone was creeping up on him. He jumped to his feet and looked around. Rachel was making soft sounds, awakening from her nap at the same time as her father. Braun Lamia lay motionless where he had left her, Med Telltale still glowing green, brain activity readout a flat red. He had slept for at least an hour. The shadows had crept across the valley floor, and only the top of the Sphinx was still in sunlight as the sun broke free of the clouds. Shafts of light slanted through the valley entrance and illuminated the cliff walls opposite. The wind was rising, but nothing moved in the valley. Saul lifted Rachel, rocked her as she cried, and ran down the steps, looking behind the Sphinx and toward the other tombs.
"Paul!" His voice echoed off rock.
Wind stirred dust beyond the jade tomb, but nothing else stirred. Saul still had the feeling that something was sneaking up on him, that he was being watched. Rachel screamed and wiggled in his grasp, her voice the high, thin wail of a newborn. Saul glanced at his comm log. She would be one day old in an hour. He searched the sky for the consul's ship, cursed softly at himself, and went back to the entrance to the Sphinx to change the baby's diaper, check on Braun, pull a nursing pack from his bag, and grab a cloak. The heat dissipated quickly when the sun was gone. In the half hour of twilight remaining, Saul moved quickly down the valley, shouting Duray's name and peering into the tombs without entering. Past the jade tomb where Hoyt had been murdered, its sides already beginning to show a milky green. Past the dark obelisk, its shadow thrown high on the southeastern cliff wall. Past the crystal monolith, its upper reaches glowing with the last of the day's light, then fading as the sun set somewhere beyond the city of poets. In the sudden chill and hush of evening, past the cave tombs, Saul shouting into each and feeling the dank air against his face like a cold breath from an open mouth. No answer. In the last of the twilight, around the bend in the valley to the blade and buttress riot of the Shrike Palace, dark and ominous in the growing gloom. Saul stood at the entrance trying to make sense of the ink-black shadows, spires, rafters, and pylons. Shouted into the dark interior, only his echo answered. Rachel began to cry again. Shivering, feeling a chill on the back of his neck, wheeling constantly to surprise the unseen watcher, and seeing only deepening shadows and the first of the night stars between clouds above, Saul hurried back up the valley toward the Sphinx, walking quickly at first, and then almost running past the jade tomb as the evening wind rose with a sound of children screaming.
"God damn!" breathed Saul as he reached the top of the stairs to the Sphinx. Braun Lamia was gone. There was no sign of her body or the metal umbilical. Cursing, holding Rachel tight, Saul fumbled through his pack for the flashlight. 10 meters down the central corridor, Saul found the blanket Braun had been wrapped in. Beyond that, nothing. The corridors branched and twisted, now widening, now narrowing as the ceiling lowered to the point that Saul was crawling, holding the baby in his right arm so that her cheek was next to his. He hated being in this tomb. His heart was pounding so fiercely that he half expected to have a coronary then and there. The last corridor narrowed to nothing. Where the metal cable had snaked into stone, now there was only stone. Saul held the flashlight in his teeth and slapped at the rock, shoved at stones the size of houses, as if a secret panel would open, tunnels would be revealed. Nothing. Saul hugged Rachel tighter and began to make his way out, taking several wrong turns, feeling his heart race even more wildly as he thought himself lost. Then they were in a corridor he recognized, then in the main corridor, then out. He carried his child to the bottom of the steps and away from the Sphinx. At the head of the valley he stopped, sat on a low rock, and panted for breath. Rachel's cheek still lay against his neck, and the baby made no sound, no movement other than the soft curl of fingers against his beard. Wind blew in from the barrens behind him. Clouds opened above and then closed, hiding the stars so that the only light came from the sick glow of the time tombs. Saul was afraid that the wild beating of his heart would frighten the baby. But Rachel continued to curl calmly against him, her warmth a tactile reassurance. "Damn," whispered Saul. He had cared for Braun Lamia. He had cared for all of the pilgrims. And now they were gone. Saul's decades as an academic had preconditioned him to hunt for patterns in events, a moral grain in the accreted stone of experience. But there had been no pattern to events on Hyperion, merely confusion and death. Saul rocked his child and looked out on the barrens, considering leaving this place at once, walking to the dead city or Kronos Keep, walking northwest to the littoral or southeast to where the bridal range intersected the sea. Saul raised a shaky hand to his face and rubbed his cheek. There would be no salvation in the wilderness.
Leaving the valley had not saved Martin Silenus. The shrike had been reported far south of the Bridal Range, as far south as Endymion and the other southern cities. And even if the monster spared them, starvation and thirst would not. Saul might survive on plants, rodent flesh, and snowmelt from the high places, but Rachel's supply of milk was limited, even with the supplies Braun had brought back from the keep. Then he realized that the milk supply did not matter. "I'll be alone in less than a day." Saul stifled a moan as the thought struck him. His determination to save his child had brought him across 2.5 decades and 100 times that many light years. His resolve to return Rachel's life and health to her was an almost palpable force, a fierce energy which he and Sarai had shared and which he had kept alive the way a temple priest preserves the sacred temple flame. No, by God, there was a pattern to things, a moral underpinning to this platform of seemingly random events, and Saul Weintraub would wager his and his daughter's lives on that belief. Saul stood, walked slowly down the trail to the Sphinx, climbed the stairs, found a therm cloak and blankets, and made a nest for the two of them on the highest step, as Hyperion winds howled and the time tombs glowed more brightly. Rachel lay on his chest and stomach, her cheek on his shoulder, her tiny hands curling and uncurling, as she released the world for the land of infant sleep. Saul heard her gentle breathing as she moved into deep slumber, heard the soft sound as she blew tiny bubbles of saliva. After a while, he released his own hold on the world and joined her in sleep.